From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Simpson Beach.
I live in Noe Valley in Novato.
I live in San Anselmo right next to Fairfax.
Coming up, we'll talk with the founder of a local organization that wants to bring more women into the tech world.
Women are great at communicating. So I think things like design and coding, even though maybe we haven't been told that we're good at this, we could be poised to actually be very good at it.
Then we take a whiff of nature and poetry in Golden Gate Park's Shakespeare Garden.
Along the fence there is the eglantine roses.
What's an eglantine rose?
Oh, I just found out what it is. It's an old tea rose, so it spreads, it puts up a very nice flower.
And the story behind this week's audiograph sound is revealed.
We feel very privileged to come down here every Wednesday morning and row on this beautiful urban lake.
Tech and nature today on Cross Currents. Jobs in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, are major drivers of the economy, especially here in the tech-crazy Bay Area. But despite efforts at change, men still dominate STEM industries. Today, we'll hear the first in a series of interviews with women in STEM, and we'll start by talking about technology. While some high-profile women like Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook or Marissa Meyer at Yahoo have made it to the top of the tech world, few women are waiting to succeed them. Consider this. In 2010, women earned just 18% of computer science degrees, compared to a high of 37% back in 1986. And while women are the main users of online social networking and e-commerce, most leaders of these companies are men. Shaharoz Charania is co-founder and CEO of Women 2.0, a company that offers networking events, conferences, and online tools with the aim of increasing the presence of women in the tech world. KALW's Jen Chien spoke with Charania about the company's beginnings and the future of women in tech.
So when we first got started, we were literally doing just networking events that we called wine and cheese. And we bought cheap Trader Joe wine and, you know, cheap cheese and invited people to our own apartments. People we didn't even know. We just said, hey, we're doing a networking event. Come to our house.
And we'll this was specifically for women?
It was open to everyone. Two guys would come from time to time, right? It was like all these women and a few good men. It was great. And they were men who basically were very open about the fact that we needed more women in tech. So there were supportive people coming in. And we did our first conference in 2006. April 2006 is when we did our first conference. And actually, our really first event was our first conference. And it was just, you know, something we put together pretty quickly. We didn't take it too seriously. We said, hey, let's just put as many female founders, female executives in tech we can on our stage and see what happens. And we did that, you know, we did that once a year, but we did these events once a month for 5 years to build community, build awareness, build a place for people to go and connect. Because when you want to drive new innovation, it's about bringing people together who decide they want to commit to making a change in whatever industry they're interested in. And so if we don't have a place for women to connect with other men and women, this wasn't going to change at the very basic level of starting a company. So founding teams and, you know, finding investors and finding your first hire, that was the whole point of bringing people together.
Was there also an aspect of kind of mutual support in those gatherings too? Did women talk about challenges they were facing in the workplace or feeling like the only girl in the room and how that doesn't feel good?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it wasn't so much a part of the conversation. Everyone who attended the event the events were really just interested in pushing forward. They were really just meeting to talk about business and to talk about what their next move was going to be. And very rarely did we have the conversation about, you know, I'm a woman in tech and this is hard. It's hard to be in tech, period. Men or women. It's a very competitive environment. It's hard to be a founder of a company also in tech or not in tech. In general, being an entrepreneur is hard. So there was just the sort of non-gender challenges that would come up. And yes, women have specific challenges. We weren't ignoring them. And people would bring them up, but it was not the main part of the conversation. It was really more about, okay, here we are. We're in Silicon Valley, one of the most competitive cities in the world. How do I get ahead? Period.
I want to talk about the culture of tech and the culture of the workplace mm-hmm. in tech. In terms of women, what do you think is there in that culture that either is welcoming to women mm-hmm. or what's there that still keeps women from achieving all that they could.
So what's welcoming to tech for women or to anyone, really, is the creativity, the sort of openness of, you know, work style. It's because tech is new, there are very few prescribed roles that go back more than 10 years. Like the product manager just popped up in the last 10 years. What's a product manager? You know, there's no like definition of how do you get to become a product manager in some ways. Like people have expectations, oh, you should be an engineer, you should have done this work and that work. But really, I mean, I became a product manager by learning it on the job. And it's a respected role to have. So I think that that's exciting for anyone really to enter technology because it's defining, the roles are being defined as we speak. I think in an environment like a tech startup or even these mid to growing size tech companies, there's also a culture that's all about allowing flexible work. And so I think that's open and exciting to women and men who, you know, want to be able to work from home or, you know, have a little bit more of a flexible schedule. And I think sort of the last piece is that we're sort of defining the future through these tech companies. And so people who are open-minded and like to embrace the unknown can really understand how to be part of a tech company. And that comes by being a multitasker, right? Because when you don't know the unknown, you're going to have to react to so many different things, whether, you know, your product fails or doesn't fail or your product does well, you're going to have to react and decide, oh, should I change the design? Should I change the marketing? Should I change the code? And to have the ability to think on your feet and quickly switch. Well, women are known to be great multitaskers. So I think there's a lot there. I think another piece is that we think of coding and designing as an expression, right? So coding is really a language. It's communicating. Mm-hmm. Designing is also the expression of something you're trying to say. Women are great at communicating. So I think things like design and coding, even though maybe we haven't been told that we're good at this, we could be poised to actually be very good at it. And so I think there's that as well, where, you know, as natural communicators, we're probably really good at the things we don't know we're good at. Uh-huh. And so what's challenging about these environments? Well, historically, tech environments are male-dominated. And when you think of a new tech startup, for example, I've seen this all the time. I have friends who start companies, and they look back at me, and they go, we have no women on our team. And we just did beer pong. And
wait, what's beer pong?
It's a good question. I think it depends on which college campus you went to. But what I've seen is essentially little cups of beer on a ping pong table, ping pong balls being thrown into the beer. If you get it in or you don't get it in, one or the other, basically you're taking shots of beer as a way to socialize. Totally off-putting, I think, to some people, not to all women, but I wouldn't be excited about beer pong. I don't like beer, right? But no, other people do, and it's fine. But it's that environment that create that sort of macho environment that some people thrive in and some people don't. And you don't have to be a woman to thrive or fail in that environment. You have to just be aware that that's a macho environment. A man can equally be appalled by
beer pong.
Yeah, as a woman. So I don't think that it's about men or women. It's about what's your level. How much are you going to tolerate, really? So my thing about that is that can easily be mitigated as long as you have a female on the founding team. And I've seen it time and time again. A female joins a startup and the culture just switches like you wouldn't believe. You know, they're doing different types of activities that are still needed, team building and, you know, drinking and all that. But whatever it is, it takes a different form. It mm-hmm. doesn't have to be in a form that's sort of
frat boy or very sounds
fratty.
Like.
Yeah, macho and fratty. It could be something a little more balanced. And so, you know, while these will exist until, you know, women are on the founding team of a startup, then that's what it is, right? And just know that if you're going to join a company where the founding team has that culture, very little chance that it's going to change. So we've seen women, you know, be a part of the founding team and from the beginning create a balanced culture that, you know, respects masculine and feminine, you know, and you do different things and you're more welcoming and I've seen these women found companies, and in, right in between raising money, they go off and have their child and come back. And so that sets a precedent of, oh, I can continue to work really hard at this company, but know that I can step out, have my children, and come right back and be okay with that. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's solutions to this strange culture that does exist here. It is here, but it's something that, you know, we should embrace what's good about it, right? And, you know, over time, toss away what, you know, can be intimidating to many people.
Shaharoz Charania is co-founder and CEO of Women 2.0. She spoke with KALW's Jen Sheehan. Women 2.0's annual conference is taking place today and tomorrow at the Hotel Kabuki in San Francisco's Japantown. For more information, go to KALW.org, click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Last week, we aired a report about how some Bay Area cities are making it easier for those with a criminal record to find jobs by eliminating the application checkbox that asks you about your criminal history. It's an initiative called Ban the Box.
It's not about what we've done in our past, but what we do now to better our futures.
That's Michelle Walker, who has a criminal record and thinks that removing the question on job applications will make it easier for her to find work. Richmond, Berkeley, and San Francisco are all banning the criminal record box in some form, and cities across the country are also removing the question that some find discriminatory. We asked what you think. Here's some of what you had to say.
First voice message.
Hi, my name is Joe. You know, you guys are normally pretty open-minded, and I didn't hear the other side of the story. There was no mention of any fear from employers. You mentioned that they wouldn't want to have people who are ex-cons, but you didn't mention the reasoning behind that, perhaps of, you know, future danger in the workplace. If they have a bad day, they could snap and revert to old criminal tendencies. I mean, that entire angle on the story was left out, and I'd really like to hear you guys discuss it.
Next message.
Hello, my name is Bob, and I've been a player for 40 years. It is nice to know what the background of somebody is, so people can stand on their own value when you meet them. And if they have a criminal background, I've had many of them working for me at one time, and usually had no problem, but I didn't have the law telling me what to do either. It was more important the character that they represented at the time. Thank you.
Next message.
Hi, Thomas Mulhall. I really like the policy that I heard on your radio program about having an interview before the possible criminal background comes up. I have hired people in the past, and I got to tell you, just like the lady that was on that interview where she said, look, you know, I was able to demonstrate my work ethic, my knowledge of the subject matter, and my enthusiasm and energy I bring to the job and not be automatically disqualified by some sort of criminal record.
End of new messages.
Find more about Ban the Box on our website, KALW.org, and click on Cross Currents. And we always love to hear from you. Give us a call and leave us your feedback at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba.
What's in a name? That which you call a rose. By any other name would smell as sweet.
In San Francisco, there's one special place where you'll find flowers from the writings of William Shakespeare. Just west of the bustle of the California Academy of Sciences sits a garden dedicated to English literature's crowned prince. You can easily miss it, but once you pass through the entrance gate and walk down a worn brick path, you're transported into an English garden filled with manicured flower beds, trimmed lawns, and people escaping the noise of the city.
KALW's Jeremy Dalmas visited the garden and brought back this story.
Thanks, Tommy. Let me see if I can find it up here. Because... I know a bank whereon the wild thyme blows, where oxlips and nodding violet grows, quite over, canopied with luscious woodbine, with sweet musk roses and with eglantine, there sleeps Titania, some time of the night, lulled in these flowers with dances and delight.
Joe Shimoleski is scanning a row of bronze plaques. Each one is stamped with quotes from William Shakespeare's works.
And that comes from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
We're in the garden of Shakespeare's flowers. It's an enclosed nook of Golden Gate Park that's filled only with plants mentioned in the writings of the bard. Shemoleski is one of the park's gardeners, and he loves the flowers here.
Along the fence there is the eglantine roses.
What's an eglantine rose?
Oh, I just found out what it is. It's a great rose. It's an old tea rose, so it spreads, it puts out a very nice flower, but then you just get this brilliant rose hip behind it. And so, yeah, it's very nice. Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so, so that's what that is.
This garden, though it's special, is not really unique.
This is one of several Shakespeare gardens throughout the country, and there are several others around the world. And they're all basically outlined the same way, 17th century classical garden.
Cleveland, Manhattan, Vienna, Johannesburg, all of them have Shakespeare gardens. Most of them were built in the early part of the 1900s. This one opened in the summer of 1929. And there's a reason why there are Shakespeare gardens and not Mark Twain or Hemingway gardens. Eric Anderson, the superintendent of Golden Gate Park, says that the bard's work translates well to landscaping.
He mentions plants really vividly and really in depth in a lot of his works.
Do you have a favorite flower here? Or a favorite tree?
To be honest, my favorite tree is the cedar here.
The tree stretches tall above the flowers, presiding over the entire garden.
It's a great specimen, and I suspect that it was one of the original plantings, and it's a really beautifully shaped specimen covered in Spanish moss.
Lauren Sabadin comes to the garden often. Today, she's lying on a blanket with an old book.
I was actually just reading my poetry book and trying to draw some inspiration and awesome. Do some writing.
The book that she's reading from is actually the same age as the garden, filled with poems from the early 1900s. She reads me part of her favorite one. It's called The Philosopher.
And what are you that, missing you, I should be kept awake as many nights as there are days with weeping for your sake? And what are you that, missing you, as many days as crawl, I should be listening to the wind and looking at the wall. I know a man that's braver man, and 20 men as kind. And what are you that you should be the one man in my mind?
That's so nice.
Yes, she has
Who
a crush
that?
On a philosopher. Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Beyond inspiration, Sabadin says the garden offers her a refuge.
It's my escape from the bustle of the city streets. Yeah, come down to just enjoy the beauty and peace and quiet. I love to read and write and nap down here. Catch up on my sleep a little bit.
You know, a part of the...
Shemoleski, the gardener, is getting ready to leave. He's about to lock up a set of steel shutters that enclose the bust of Shakespeare himself. It's a unique replica of a famous one from the writer's hometown in England. He's holding a quill and looking straight ahead, like he's posing for me. And there's an inscription under the statue. A gift to our city from the town of Stratford-upon-Avon and its former mayor, Archibald Flower. Oh, wow.
You know,
that's lucky that we got it.
Yeah, right.
Park Superintendent Anderson says they normally keep the statue locked away. Perhaps, back in 1929, you could have valuable busts sitting out in the open. But not so these days. In fact, if you look where there are supposed to be six plaques with Shakespeare quotes, today, there are only four, and a couple of blank spaces. Those two plaques were wrenched off the wall in 2008, most likely stolen to be sold for scrap metal. No matter how tranquil it may seem here, we are still in the middle of 21st century San Francisco. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
Thank you.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now let's take a stroll from the garden to the waterfront. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound.
Prepare to give way together on the count of three. One, two, three.
We asked what you think it is and where in the Bay Area it's from. KALW's Jen Chien brings us the answer.
If it's not raining, we row. My name is Valerie Montes, and I'm currently the president of the Oakland Women's Rowing Club. It's been going for almost 100 years. My mother-in-law was a member. So I've known about the club since about 1980, and I was working then, and I felt that I was much too young to belong to the Oakland Women's Rowing Club because I thought, oh, well, it's a bunch of old ladies. Well, of course, now I'm an old lady. Well, getting there. I don't know what the median age is, but I know that it's somewhere around 70 or 75. Something like that. There's some younger, some older. We have one member who's 90. We line up at 9:30. There's usually about 40 of us line up for the four boats. And we row from 10 until 11.
Oars.
Prepare to give way together on the count of three. One, two, three. These winter months are wonderful because you get all the bird life and the wild birds, I don't know the names of half of them, but we get egrets and herons and ducks and cormorants and pelicans. We get gray and white pelicans, and sometimes they fly and then you see them diving into the water sometimes when we're out there rowing, which is fun, and they always get their fish. I don't know how they see the fish, but they do. We see people walking around the lake every day. Sometimes if we row along the shoreline, people wave to us.
Hi. Good morning.
They're happy to see us. We're happy to see them.
Lovely day for a row.
And sometimes the fountains are working. There's one over there by East 18th Street. Sometimes we get a little close on purpose, get wet. And of course the other sounds we hear around the lake are of all the traffic, which isn't necessarily good, but it's okay. It's just one of those background sounds. If we're not all talking, which some do, some don't, you can hear the oars against the water, and it's that nice sort of lap-lap sound. When it's good weather, it's just wonderful being out here. It's good exercise. There's a good camaraderie between the ladies. We feel very privileged to come down here every Wednesday morning and row on this beautiful urban lake.
Congratulations to Sybil Marcus. You guessed correctly, and so we're sending you a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there will be another contest next week. Here's a sneak peek at the sound. Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? Give us a call if you do and tell us all about it. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. That does it for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Maya DePaola Hanica, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Christina Loring, Ryan Miller, Seth Samuel, Julia Scott, Stephen Short, and Todd Whitney. Today's show was produced by Ashley Ann Krigbaum and engineered by Chris Hoff. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And because of your support, we can proudly say we are listener-supported public radio. This band you're listening to is Frankie Boots and the County Line. They're from Sebastopol, and they're going to take part in the weekly Free Twang Sundays at the Parkside in San Francisco. That's this Sunday at 4 o'clock. All the details are at klw.org. Click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. I don't mind saying I don't like friend no more.